This is Bob, Groz, and Tom.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio and streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Hour number three of Bob, Groz, and Tom with Groz and Tom, 710 ESPN Seattle. Day has just zoomed by, as Mondays tend to do.
Hasn't it?
It has.
It's been almost the speed of a Kentucky Derby.
Fastest 2 minutes in sports.
2 minutes. Or in our case, 180 minutes.
I'm going to make a prediction for you, Tom.
What's that?
About something you don't care about.
Okay.
The Kentucky Derby. The horse that won it's going to win the Triple Crown this year. Be the second Triple Crown in 3 years.
The favorite is winning a lot of these races.
Last eight
just in general
in the Derby.
Yeah.
But this guy's going to win the Triple Crown.
And it won't be as big of a deal.
Well, it just happened a couple years ago with American Pharoah, mm-hmm. your favorite horse.
It is my favorite horse,
yeah.
Other than Barbaro. All right, for the latest on what's going on at Seahawks headquarters, rookie mini camp over the weekend, we bring in ESPN's Brady Henderson. Brady, how you doing?
Ross and Tom, how's it going? I'm doing well. What's up with you guys?
Brady appears on the Venue Kings hotline. All right, we talked to Alex Magoo the other day, but tell us why he's getting rave reviews out there.
Yeah, I mean, he was, I think, one of the standout players of the rookie minicamp. And, I mean, I guess the simplest way to say it is he just looked like a quarterback. And I think it's important to keep in mind that that's a pretty tough setting for a quarterback to come into when you know, it's your first rookie minicamp practice. You have maybe a fraction of the playbook down. You're throwing to receivers you've never thrown to before. And a lot of those receivers are guys that, quite frankly, aren't going to be there beyond the weekend. And yet he showed, you know, really good arm strength, which is something that Pete Carroll noted was really accurate, seemed to have a good command of everything. So, he looked like a quarterback. And obviously we're a long, long ways away from any sort of decision on who's going to be the backup. I would still think that it's going to be it's more likely that Austin Davis keeps that job than Alex Magoo. And, you know, we'll have to see how Magoo handles, things when, you know, it's veterans in camp, you're, you know, playing in the preseason against other teams. There's a long, long way to go there, but I think that it was a pretty good first impression for him.
Has there ever been a rookie more hyped, there was more anticipation for to see than Shaquem Griffin in your experience?
Yeah, with the Seahawks, I mean, maybe going back to 2010 when they had the two first-round picks in Russell Okung and Earl Thomas, but, maybe that was more anticipation of, you know, things in general as opposed to one player individually. Yeah, I would agree with that, Grant, that they're, you know, all eyes were on him. You know, when we first got there for the first practice Friday and they were warming up, I mean, all guys were doing, you know, they were literally just stretching and sort of doing the little agility drills, you know, from, you know, 10 yards away, going back and forth. And that was, you know, there was a row of reporters lined up to take video of it. So I can't remember a time where there's been more attention paid to it. And, you know, unfortunately, this was not really a setting where you were going to learn a whole lot about Shaquem Griffin because, you know, so much of what he's able to do in the NFL, especially as a rookie, is going to be how he handles, you know, the transition to tackling in the NFL.
Sure.
With only having one hand. And that's just not something that you're going to learn about in a rookie minicamp because, you know, there's no contact. The guys are only wearing helmets and no shoulder pads. So I think that'll make training camp, you know, once they do start hitting, I think all eyes are still going to be on him for that reason.
Did he come into the camp like too fired up? Was he told to tone it down or something?
Yeah, that's what Pete Carroll said. He I think he made mention of that in reference to the walkthrough that they had where, it's like it sounds like a walkthrough, so you're not supposed to be going all that fast. But, yeah, he said that was one of the first things that Carroll said is that they kind of had to temper him a little bit and kind of had to slow him down because he was maybe a little bit too amped up for his first rookie minicamp practice.
Michael Dixon did something that a punter can't normally do, which is stand out, didn't he?
He did, yeah. You do not expect to hear a lot about punters in rookie minicamp. And I'll give you a very technical scouting term here, Groz, when I say that he was kicking the crap out of the football. Okay, like, you know, we were standing behind him on Saturday. They were doing this little competition. It was kind of just I guess the competition was to see who could catch punts from him, but I think the Seahawks also wanted to put him kind of under the microscope a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were standing behind him as he was doing it, and I would compare it to if you've ever been to a golf tournament and you've either seen pros hit from behind or seen them warm up on the range from behind, you get really get an appreciation for the ball flight and how impressive that is. But you just can't tell on TV, and even from the behind angle on TV, you just really can't get an appreciation for it like you can in person. And it was kind of the same thing. Just the ball flight. Not only was it hanging in the air forever and going, I couldn't tell exactly how far it was going, but you know, he was booting it. It also had this crazy movement on it that, I think combined with maybe there's a little bit of a wind that day, and it made it seem like it would be treacherous to try to field a punt from that guy. That was kind of a sight to behold on Saturday. And, again, we'll see what happens in the regular season. But, you know, if he's ticking like that, you know, when you talk about the weather that you get in Seattle at CenturyLink Field in November, December, that's something that could cause some problems for returners. And I wonder if, you know, maybe that could cause a couple turnovers a season just because of how, the movement that he gets on those balls and how difficult that could be to field.
Brady Henderson of ESPN.com joins us via the Venue Kings hotline. Now, Brady, how much competition is there going to be for the punting job between he and John Ryan?
Yeah, you know, the comments that Pete Carroll and John Schneider have made it sound like they're going to give John Ryan a chance to win that job, and you know, as well, I think they should. But I think when you draft a punter in the fifth round, and not only do that, but trade up in the fifth round, which cost them another seventh-round pick, so you gave up a fifth and a seventh for him, I think you've got a pretty good idea of what he is. And you know, I was talking to another writer about this. I wonder if the plan is, give him – sort of maybe let it go through OTAs and maybe even the mini camp just to make sure that you have what you think you have in Michael Dixon and then make a decision there. And, you know, a benefit to doing it that way, if you are going to move on from John Ryan, I think it you'd be doing right by him by doing it a little earlier than training camp, because that way you give him time to latch on with another team. And, you know, I don't mean to say that this is, you know, a foregone conclusion. And John Schneider even mentioned this after the draft, that he was with the team before. He may have said the Packers, and they drafted a punter, I think, in one of the earlier rounds, and it didn't end up working. And I think the guy who, the guy who had the job ended up keeping the job. So it's not a guarantee. But like I said, when you spend as much as the Seahawks have had, as the Seahawks spent on Michael Dixon, I think they've got a pretty good idea of what they have in him.
Yeah, if he doesn't make it, that's going to be really disappointing using up that draft capital for it. Did anyone else jump out at you, Brady?
You know, there was actually an undrafted kind of a tryout guy there that looked pretty good, Demaurier Stringfellow. And he was, you know, that name should ring a bell here, because he played for UW. Obviously, he had the off-field incident that led to his departure from UW. He ended up at Ole Miss. And I think he went undrafted a couple years ago. He's kind of bounced around. And, you know, he was one of their better-looking receivers there. He wasn't one of the three true undrafted guys that they had in camp this year, but I think he was maybe the guy who stood out the most among those receivers. And as Pete Carroll said yesterday, they're always looking for those bigger receivers. Stringfellow is, I think, 6'2", over 200 pounds, so he would be one of the bigger receivers on Seattle's roster. And you know, again, we're in May here, so there's a very long way to go here. But I think that you know, I wonder if he had maybe even earned himself, at the very least, just, you know, a shot at a contract and a shot to stick around, through OTAs at the very least.
You get a sense, Brady, the Seahawks still have the dream of a big, tall, oversized wide receiver that they've had since Pete Carroll got here?
Yeah, I definitely do. And I think it's important to look at the receivers that they took a look at in free agency. Obviously, they signed Jerron Brown, who's 6'2", 205 pounds, but they also took a look at Terrell Pryor. They were going to have a visit. They had a visit scheduled with Jordy Nelson before he signed with the Raiders. So it does seem like they've had their eyes on those big receivers. And it's no wonder, you know, when you look at their top two guys, Doug Baldwin, Tyler Lockett, both guys under 6 feet, around, you know, less than 200 pounds, or maybe Baldwin, maybe a little over that. But at any rate, you know, there's not a whole lot of size at the top end of that depth chart. So, they've spent picks on guys like that, you know, with Amara Darboh and David Moore last year. Both are bigger guys. Obviously, those guys have yet to really prove anything. So, I think that the search continues there, no doubt.
Brady, if Earl Thomas doesn't show up to mandatory minicamp, this is in, what, mid-June, you will think what about his future?
I will start to wonder, you know, how obstinate he's going to be in his desire for a new contract. I wouldn't say that, you know, it's any guarantee by any means that he's going to hold out. You know, John Schneider, you know, had the comment recently, I think it was last month, where he said that he's been told, you know, by Earl's representatives that Earl will not hold out, and which was kind of counter to what everybody had thought, you know, because Earl had the comments at the Pro Bowl about, you know, he had mentioned the possibility of holding out then. You know, if he does miss that minicamp, he would subject himself to fines. The team doesn't have to impose those. It's kind of at the team's discretion. But you're talking about potentially losing a whole lot of money there. And what's also important to keep in mind here, it's worth noting that, you know, Cam Chancellor, when he held out in 2015, he was there at minicamp. It wasn't until training camp that he started holding out. And I believe it was the same with Marshawn Lynch in 2014. I think he was there at minicamp, and then it wasn't until the first week of training camp that he sat out. So if Earl Thomas misses it, I think that could be a sign of, you know, how much he's going to stick to his guns. But at the same time, you never know. He could miss that and then show up for training camp.
Rashad Penny made his debut. What do you think ultimately the Seahawks' hopes are for him in his rookie season?
I mean, I think that they would love it if he took over the job and you know, didn't let it go. I think that, you know, when you draft a guy in the first round like they did, the running back, I think that's a good sign that they think he can be that. Now, we'll see. They're definitely not going to give him that job. You know, that's just not the way that they operate. And they've got a pretty good running back coming back in Chris Carson. And by all accounts, he looks, he seems to be, you know, like he was, or at least, you know, he seems to be recovered from that injury you know, that knocked him out last season. So, you know, I think it's important to remember, and I'm writing about this for tomorrow, is that, you know, he was very durable in college. And for all of the issues that they've had in their backfield since Marshawn Lynch left, and even, you know, in 2015 when Lynch went down, it's just been a constant cycle of running backs because none of those guys have been able to stay healthy. Rawls looked like he was going to be the guy, then he got hurt. You know, C.J. Procise, we all know his injury history. And even Carson last year, when, you know, as good as he looked early, and then for his season to end because of the injury was pretty disappointing. So, you know, I think a hope for him is to stay healthy and to take that job. And I still think that even if he does end up as a starter, that they'll mix in Carson, just to not burden the guy, you know, right away. But I think that, you know, I think that was a big deal to them, is his durability. 54 of a possible 54 games in college, when everything, you know, with all the instability that Seattle's backfield has had since Marshawn Lynch left.
Hey, Brady, I won't ask you to do it right now, but could you actually recite C.J. Procise's injury history from memory?
Possibly. Yeah, maybe. Okay. You know, there may be one or two that I would miss. There was a groin, a hamstring, a scapula, a wrist. Yeah, I'm probably missing a few in there, but those were the big ones, I think.
Don't
forget about the scapula, Tom.
I won't forget about the scapula.
It was a good get right there, Brady. That might be what we call a good get.
That might be the one that I actually remember. Does it feel significantly different in any way over there? Just new coaching staff, obviously younger players. But does the vibe feel differently over there?
It does, and I think that probably won't really sink in until we get to OTAs and that first open OTA that's open to the media. Just because there's so many guys that you're used to seeing there that either aren't going to be there, you know, like Richard Sherman, Michael Bennett, Cliff Averill, probably not going to see Cam Chancellor there either. And there's going to be a lot of new coaches there. You know, we've already seen, you know, kind of how Brian Schottenheimer likes to operate. He's very, you know, hands-on in the huddles and everything. And that was one thing that Pete Carroll talked a lot about when he was talking about why they like Brian Schottenheimer, talking about his work with quarterbacks and how hands-on he's been. I think he's going to be even more hands-on with Russell Wilson than Darrell Bevell was. And also, you know, you've got Ken Norton back, and anybody who's ever watched a Seahawks practice knows that Ken Norton's voice, it's so loud that it cuts through the music that is blaring through the speakers. You know, and so that's, I mean, I guess that'll be different in one sense because he hasn't been there for a couple of years, but also familiar in another sense because he was there for so many years under Pete Carroll. So, yeah, there's just a lot of new personnel there, a lot of freshness, I think was the word that Pete Carroll used. So it'll definitely feel different, yeah.
Were you ever going to find out what happened to Malik McDowell?
Boy, that's a really good question. I mean, I think I don't think that all of the details are ever going to really come out there. And you know, I understand why. It's a legal issue, you know, is my understanding of it, because it was an injury that happened off of, you know, away from the team facility, And I think that the Seahawks have to be careful because of that. You know, there's only so much that they can say about it. I think that, you know, maybe they're protecting themselves in case something happens there. So I don't know. I mean, you know, the details may come out eventually. I don't know if we're ever going to hear that from the Seahawks, though, and I totally understand why.
Yeah.
We saw Cliff Averill's career come to an end. Any sense of what's going on with Cam Chancellor?
No, you know, he had a, I think he had a, an Instagram post recently that said he's got an upcoming scan in the near future, and that, you know, he I forget the wording of it, but he seemed to indicate that that was going to play, you know, a big part in his future. And, you know, it's kind of up in the air. I've heard that, you know, it's not as how can I say this? It's not as doubtful as maybe a lot of people seem to think it is, that maybe there is a chance that he could come back. And I don't say that to get anybody's hopes up, because there's been no, you know, firm indication of that. So it's maybe not the foregone conclusion that people think it may be, but it's from the sounds of it, just from that Instagram post he had, you know, maybe something big could be coming up pretty soon that will, you know, play a big role in determining that.
Wow, I'd be pretty surprised. Brady Henderson joins us on the Venue Kings hotline from ESPN. Thanks, Brady.
You bet, guys. Thank you.
Wouldn't you be shocked if Cam Chancellor came back and played?
Yes.
I mean, I look at both he and Averill. I know this isn't the right way to look at it, but like they're being held together by a thread or something. Their bodies physically.
Right.
Right? Like one big hit out there could just cause something that none of us want to see.
Well, that's always a risk that NFL players run anyway. I mean, the question is he running more of a risk?
Right.
That's what he'll make his decision.
More of a risk, and how much more of a risk?
Right.
That's what the scan is for, I'm sure.
Right, is to determine, you know, whether or not, and I would hope part of it is not only to determine that, but is to determine what happens if I take another hit like I did before.
Yeah.
Will the outcome be worse? Will it be the same? That sort of stuff. If it's the same, then and there's no greater risk, I'm sure he'll probably give it a shot.
Is he in a position where what kind of competition is he up against at that point? Because remember, it's not like he's right smack dab in his prime with this injury.
No, he's not.
This is later in his career anyway.
And
so,
he's played very little the last 2 years.
Exactly. So it might be tough on him anyway.
Yeah, I would think so, although I would think that he would have a leg up.
Just because he's Cam Chancellor.
Right.
And he knows what the deal is and what it's going to take to be able to go out there and actually compete and
all that.
Keep his job, even if he wins it.
Exactly.
Or it's not given to somebody else to keep his job through the season. You know, the Malik...
But I still agree with you. I still think it'd be a surprise.
I'd be very separate. I'd put it at like 90% no.
Yeah.
But if there's that 10% chance, who knows? With the Malik McDowell thing, if the news ever comes out that, you know, we find out what happened, do you think we're going to be surprised at what's revealed?
What do you think happened?
I think he was in an ATV accident and he fell over, injured himself badly, and couldn't play.
Hit his head. And
yeah.
If we find out something else, would you be surprised?
You mean if it's something?
So I'm just turning it back on. I'm turning it back on you. We've got meaning that even though we don't know what it is, everyone's got a sense of what they think it is.
Like if he were in a fight, a barroom fight, or something like that,
or anything else,
that would be surprising. Yeah.
Yeah. If it was something else entirely.
Yes, if it was anything unrelated to like a recreational accident.
Yeah, so you kind of answered your own question there. If it comes out that what we had heard whispered at was true, then there's no surprise.
Right, then I'll wonder where the ATV rumor came from. Maybe him.
Right, and then you still wonder, I mean, what could have possibly happened on an ATV that ends a guy's career in this particular way? Because remember, we've seen video of him screaming about his taxes and everything like that. So, you know, it's the question is, now he's a guy who may have taken a shot that they said, look, you take another hit there, you're paralyzed.
McDowell,
yeah.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Otherwise, it's hard to fathom how just one accident, when we've subsequently seen him, you know, talking normally and all that, could have ended his career before it even began.
Right.
Right?
Well, I mean, ATVs are dangerous.
I understand that, but I mean, if we hadn't seen him at all.
On film.
On film. We saw him. He's out at Seahawks training camp for a couple days, too, looking pretty much healed. So it seems to me that what he got was he injured something that they told him, if you injure this again, you're going to be paralyzed. That's what I would expect.
Because you
if we heard the details, that would be the detail that I expect to hear.
Right, because you can come back from you can come back from a broken leg or whatever whatever injury you think you can get on an ATV.
Right.
Even if it were a burn.
Absolutely, right? You could.
And I don't mean to make light of it by saying that.
I know you don't.
You could come back from any one of those things. Even Jason Pierre-Paul, who blew
three of his fingers off,
right,
for crying out
to
loud,
smithereens, came back. So it would have to be pretty darn serious if it were an accident like that.
To me, that's what it had to be. It had to be something that if he gets hit again, it ends his career. Hmm. And excuse me, he can't walk anymore.
Right.
What else makes sense?
Nothing other than something that may have been illegal. But
yeah,
I can't. But then we're just speculating on what that could
be. Now, what that would make sense is how it's been so secretive. Because I don't necessarily agree with what Brady said. Well, there are legal reasons for keeping it secret. I don't know what those are
for the Seahawks.
From anyone, we hear about guys' injuries all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is one we don't hear about.
Well, if a guy ends up in the hospital, there might be HIPAA laws there.
Yeah, but I don't think that once you're a public figure, and it's a news story, you find out.
Yeah, but
give me another example of something like this. I just can't think of anything with a guy, and I'm not talking about an individual. I'm talking about a guy who was a prominent, first round mm-hmm. or first player selected in the draft, sort of guy, a public guy.
Or we just flat out don't know what happened?
Yeah.
Well, we know what happened with Jeff Kent, even though we don't know. When he fell off the motorcycle. Or was he cleaning the motorcycle? What was it, Curtis?
He fell off the motorcycle. He used the excuse that he was playing basketball.
But that was a story because that would violate his contract.
Okay.
Because he's trying to protect his money. I'm talking about where eventually the information got out.
Yeah, the Giants had explicitly read that he was not supposed to ride his motorcycle while under contract.
Did they make it public that that's what happened?
I think, yes.
I think they did ultimately, too.
Yeah, okay.
I just can't think of an example.
I can't either, and I'm not a lawyer. I can't tell you.
No, I'm not either, and I'm sure there are examples of it. We're just trying to do this off the top of our head.
I mean, the Giants didn't reveal what happened with Pierre-Paul until somehow Schefter unearthed that stuff. And remember, Pierre-Paul threatened to sue him.
Right.
And sue ESPN because of that.
Thinking that what we're not going to notice when he starts playing again.
Right.
Hey, you're missing some fingers.
Well, he would have had his hand wrapped up like he does, but would he be able to go the rest of his life like that? I don't know. Nobody's going to see him out in public.
Right. You found out ultimately.
Yeah.
Mysterious.
It is mysterious. Choice. We have a choice here.
Choice, you say?
Yeah, we talked a bunch about LeBron before, which I thought was interesting. So we could hear from Isaiah Thomas on him talking about...
Which Isaiah Thomas?
The Hall of Famer.
Okay.
Talking about how he's the most important person to come along in basketball since God knows when. Or we could go back to Pete Carroll, his gobbledygook about Earl Thomas.
Can we do both?
Possibly, yeah.
Let's try and do both.
All right. We'll eavesdrop next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
Bravo Golf Tango. Bravo Golf Tango. The line is in. It's time now for the eavesdrop.
And down the home stretch on Bob Grosin Town.
Something.
From the 50,000-watt blowtorch of the Pacific Northwest. 710 ESPN Seattle.
The pulse of the Northwest.
The
710.
Pulse of the Northwest.
Cairo AM. Something somebody said about stuff.
Somebody said somewhere about stuff.
That's how we usually
that's it.
Introduce this wonderful segment called the eavesdrop. We're going to eavesdrop on a guy who isn't exactly popular, Groz.
Okay.
Particularly with people back east. Anybody affiliated with the Knicks.
Isaiah?
That's Hall of Famer Isaiah Thomas. And we were talking before about LeBron James and, of course, the LeBron versus Jordan discussion and who's the better all-time player. And LeBron's got all this time left, right? He's still getting better, it seems.
It is, and he does.
Right, so the case for LeBron James seems to be getting more and more airtight as we go on. And here's Isaiah Thomas just giving his thoughts on that, being the most dominant player of all time.
When you look at his body of work over the last 15 years, you can make the argument economically that there hasn't been a more important person to come along in all basketball lifetime than LeBron James in terms of what he's done in terms of elevating the sport economically, globally, socially, so forth and so on.
You know what? It's interesting because usually you do the LeBron-Jordan debate, and it's all about what happened on the court. He's talking economically, the impact on the world.
I'm sorry, but
I would respectfully disagree. No athlete in my lifetime has had a bigger economic impact outside the game than Michael Jordan.
Given where Nike, the game was.
Nike, Michael Jordan almost single-handedly made Nike.
Okay.
The other guy, they brought other guys and brought them along and everything like that. But
Tiger.
Bo Jackson, obviously, was a big part of the whole thing starting.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Michael Jordan who took it to a new strata. Michael Jordan, who could play for $1 million a year if he wanted to, or less than that, because of how much money he was making in endorsements.
Right.
I'd internationally say, known. I would say that LeBron James has been very good for basketball. There's no and I'm of the school that he's the best player to ever play. But in terms of economic impact, I don't think he compares to Jordan.
I'll tell you what he did do. He's done what no golfer has been able to do, which is advance the game past its dependency on Tiger Woods. LeBron did that with Jordan.
Agreed.
He had not alone. There are other players, too, but LeBron, for the most part, has been at the center of getting the NBA out from underneath the shadow of Jordan.
Yeah, you're going to, when you look at the NBA, you look at it from eras, and you can say the Russell, that era, and whatnot, and then a dark period, then Magic and Bird, right to Jordan. And you could go Jordan, in theory, say, led to LeBron.
I think the way I remember it, because I actually didn't become an NBA fan until the latter years of Jordan. There was this period in the middle where it was like Tracy McGrady and Allen Iverson and
Kobe.
Paul Pierce.
Kobe and Shaq.
Yeah, that's
Kobe
fair.
Kobe Bryant was probably a better transitional character, although he had...
But he was transitional.
Obvious,
He's not LeBron in terms of that popularity.
I don't think he is either. I think, you know, in terms of how his career wound up, he overcame a very unfortunate incident.
Yeah.
That really ruined his mind in the public and sort of overcame that. And then his body of work remains very, very impressive. But
yeah, he's won all those championships.
I still don't think you'll think of an era as the Kobe era.
No, and if you do, you'll have to take a few seconds to think about what that actually is.
Right, right.
Right? I mean,
LeBron has definitely defined his era, certainly, and he's been, I mean, he's a great spokesman, all that stuff and everything like that. But Jordan was at a different level.
Right. I mean, the best time, I think, in the history of the NBA, just all-in competitive popularity, is going to be the 90s.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, there have been a couple of guys. One of them just passed away in his 80s, Arnold Palmer, who was a top 10 endorser 40 years after he played around a competitive golf. Michael Jordan is still that.
He's still doing it.
He played basketball in 15, 20 years.
Yeah, about 17 years.
When he wrapped up with the Wizards, his ill-fated comeback, which really didn't enhance his brand all that much.
No, it didn't kill him, but it didn't really do anything.
It was sort of a nothing stint. 20 years since he's been a star, and he still is. LeBron James, will he be an endorser 20 years after his career is over?
Boy, I'd have to think he is. I really believe that he is. I mean, he's already acting convincingly, by the way.
True.
He could start any TV show or internet, whatever he wants to do, he may do that. What?
May go on to another career, another high-profile career. Now, Jordan became the first team owner, basically, of the players. You know, they sort of said it in a competitive sense. So that was his thing in continuing his brand, so to speak. But he's an owner.
He's an owner.
He's reticent.
He's not as public.
No, not at all.
Remember, Jordan, the one thing that Jordan doesn't have going for him, he's not nearly as genial as LeBron is.
No.
Like, LeBron's a competitor out there and everything, but when he appears in an Amy Schumer movie and is pretty funny, right, he comes off as a really likable guy. Jordan is likable only in the sense that he goes out there and he can kill you with one shot.
Well, but he was, you know, until you really found out what he was like, which had to do with, I think, a lot of it was his Hall of Fame induction.
Yeah.
And things like that. Yeah, that wasn't really that well known about him. You knew Michael Jordan from his commercials.
You're saying publicly they didn't know Mike.
I mean, right. His public image was pretty good.
He was a god.
Yeah, it was, but it was also a benign image.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a negative image until more and more details came out.
That's true.
And we'll see what LeBron is like because he gets a chance to write another chapter.
I think, barring any major incident, you talked about Kobe Bryant before, any incident that's going to just sully his reputation permanently, I think LeBron comes off as like a guy you could be chummy with. Whereas Jordan doesn't quite have that.
I mean, LeBron almost to a paranoid sense, non-political.
Yeah.
Non-politically active. LeBron has already done things like buy graduation for all these kids, and I mean he is sparred on the political stage, so he's already more active politically.
He hasn't gone Jordan so far as to turn anybody off, though.
Not yet.
That I know.
Not really. No. Not
he
really.
Could. Have, I mean, he could if he
unless he didn't stay in his lane.
What do you mean?
As Laura Ingraham's line from Fox.
Oh yeah. Go dribble the ball or whatever.
Right. Right. but he really hasn't. But it's I mean, I agree with Isaiah. He's a significant player, but I mean, Jordan's impact was and is still unbelievable.
I think the fact that Jordan was the first to really take it to that level. It's not that Bird and Magic didn't have endorsements. They did. But Jordan took that to another level. And I don't know that LeBron is advancing that or is just doing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, who when you think of LeBron James and his sponsors, who do you think of? Now stop right there, and Curtis was going to say who it is, probably Sprite.
Okay.
Or Nike.
But yeah, but he's not necessarily identified with them the way Jordan was identified.
He's not iconically identified.
If I asked you Jordan, you'd say Nike.
I'd say Nike, or BVDs, or Hanes, or whatever.
Hanes is the one.
Hanes.
I think most people identify with Nike, but,
yeah,
but you know
I
what I mean?
I remember the underwear commercial with his father, but yeah, Nike certainly, yeah. Absolutely.
So there's a way, and so you identify him with them.
Yeah. I think of LeBron James, the one thing I think of is the powder that he throws up in the air before
right.
the game. That's when I think of LeBron James, that's the image that comes to mind.
LeBron James, the only thing he's lacking is a really, truly seminal ad campaign.
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, he's like, good endorsement, but like, be like Mike. I mean, that was.
Or Bo Jackson. Bo knows.
Jackson's was brief, was really brief, but it definitely was.
Memorable,
was
obviously.
Absolutely memorable. We remember it. But be like Mike lasted a long, long time.
Did Tiger? No, Tiger never. I mean, he was Nike also, but he never really had that kind
not
of catchphrase.
Not the same sort of thing. No. Not the same sort of thing.
Interesting. Well, we'll see what happens. And it'll be interesting to see if LeBron can guide the fifth-seeded Cavs to a championship.
If he does that, I mean, wow.
What else is there left to do on the court? Nothing.
Go to the Lakers and win there.
We sum it up next. Bob Grosin, Tom.
Hey, this is Danny O'Neill from the Danny, Dave, and Moore Show. Thank you for listening to the Bob Grosin, Tom Show. I'd really appreciate it if you checked out Danny, Dave, and Moore every afternoon from 3 to 7. You can stream us live at 710sports.com or on the 710 Sports app or listen on demand.
From the Alaska Airlines Studio,
this is Bob Grosin, Tom.
Streaming everywhere at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle app. It's time to sum it up with Bob Grosin, Tom. The final word every day on the show of record at 2:45.
I'm feeling good about the Mariners. I think you are too. I think most of the city's feeling good about the Mariners right now. I think for the most part, I think this team will stay over 500 the rest of the year. How far over 500, I don't know. But I'm a little nervous.
You are.
Yeah, and I brought this up before. Looking around the American League, I was hoping there would be one team that the Mariners would be in competition with for that extra wild card. I was hoping there'd be one team. I think there's going to be like five.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think you're going to have your three division winners, and then there's going to be five other teams, including the Mariners, that are going to be vying for two spots. Maybe Oakland will drop off. I hope that happens sooner than later.
You really think, aren't you conceding one to the Yankees and the Red Sox?
Basically, yeah. But I mean,
both of them.
Just
it's like five teams competing for one spot.
Well, that would be four, right?
Four or five teams competing for one spot. That's what I mean. I look at the Yankees or the Red Sox as kind of that year. Remember when the Yankees won 103 games, didn't make the postseason? It kind of what sprung the wild card on everyone. But it wouldn't surprise me if both those teams won 100 games this year. The way they're playing now.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Here's the point. It's not going to take 85 games to win or 85 wins to get that wild card. It's going to take probably like 92 or 3, something like that. And you may even have a situation like we've had one time before where you have to have a one-game playoff to get to a one-game playoff. Can you imagine that? Would you count that as a postseason berth? I don't think I would.
No, I'd rather not.
It counts as regular season.
Right.
Not the wild card game, but the one gamer that decides who's actually going to go there. So I'm happy that the Mariners are playing well. I expect them to hang in there, but it's unfortunate that it seems like the competition to actually get there is stiffer than ever. There's been years in the past where it could have been a heck of a lot easier to get there at 85, 86, 87 wins. They may win 88, they may win 89 or 90 and not get there. Do we call that a success?
No.
That's all I got.
Call it better, though. Well, I was proud of Seattle fans getting in touch with their inner pettiness, man. I loved it. Ohtani got booed. Got booed when he stepped to the plate the first time. Got booed when he pitched. Way to go, Seattle. I mean that, too.
He didn't get booed that hard, though, when he pitched.
Well, because they had already kind of let him have it
right,
when he batted.
Right, by Sunday.
You'd already really let him have it.
Plus, everybody was in a great mood from the night before. And it was a beautiful day.
That had something to do with it as well.
The place was packed.
And, you know, and they didn't keep it up, and that's okay. They didn't need to keep it up. Just make your statement.
With A-Rod, they keep it up, though. Or not
A-Rod, A-Rod was different, though. A-Rod was actually here. A-Rod said some stuff. Even though I thought he was unfairly criticized for leaving for a $90 million bonus, he said some things he shouldn't have said. And, you know, that was one thing.
To be fair,
Ohtani was never here.
Right. But.
Was never here.
But did he jerk the Mariners around in the offseason?
If he did, he jerked every team in baseball around but one.
True.
And, jerked around. I mean, it's a prospect you've had for a month, not a guy who's played with you for 4 or 5 years. So
right.
It was a different thing there. But I still admire the pettiness, the anger, the upset of that rejecting us sort of feeling that Seattle fans sometimes have better than any others. We have a chip on our shoulder here civically, and it was proudly on display. Unfortunately, it had no impact on Ohtani's performance. So I think that kind of goes away, too, about him not being able, because he actually had said that he wasn't used to getting booed.
Right.
He'd never really heard it before.
Now,
it certainly didn't bother him.
Was the noise continuous through his at bat? That I can't really remember. Because it wasn't when he was pitching.
I only saw his first at bat.
Okay.
Because I wanted to see what his reaction was going
to
be.
But being booed while you walk to the plate's one thing. Being booed mercilessly while you're standing there trying to do your thing.
It was what I suggested. It was significant, but it wasn't quite Alex Rodriguez-esque.
Okay.
And it was petty, and it was cool.
I think that thing that happened at Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, I think the reason why that bothered him is because it was a couple of Angel fans probably barking audibly in an otherwise quiet stadium, and that was distracting to him. If it's just a loud chorus of boos, I'm not really sure how much that actually bothers him.
I'm pretty sure it didn't bother him at all.
Because he does well.
Based on his performance.
Exactly.
I'm going to say it didn't bother him much at all.
Yeah, well, I'll admit this.
He's pretty good.
Well, he's good. I can't really argue with that, but it is interesting to watch. I thought the novelty would wear off in like a week.
I don't think it has. Do you? I think there's still some novelty to it. And maybe it's because it was his first time in, and it'll be that feeling every time he goes somewhere new. But this is, once again, a guy doing something that we've not seen.
Right. I guess
I've never seen anyone do it.
I can't decide, Graz, if I'm happy that he's in the division enough where I get to see this often, or I'm mad that he's going to be terrorizing the team I root for.
I'm leaning towards the second.
The latter?
Yeah. I'm mad. I'd just as soon see him once or twice.
Yeah, enough already.
Yeah. There's TV to watch.
Exactly.
All right, that's going to do it for us.
Congratulations, Kraus, on the pulse of the Pacific Northwest.
On the 50,000-watt blowtorch of the Pacific Northwest.
Bob Graz and Tom, 710 ESPN Seattle.
I'm a white boy and I'm jacked. Deal with it.